Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And it is always a delight to welcome back into our studios Nan Calvert for her monthly visit to the program. Nan Calvert joins us on a regular basis to bring with her interesting guests, always talking about some matter of the environment around us, the natural environment, and the role that we all play in its safekeeping or its destruction, as it so often sadly is the case. Nan Calvert has brought with her someone who is in a very important position at a very important place in the community of Racine, a place that means a great deal to a whole lot of people. Nan, I'm going to let you say who this person is and why they're here.
Well, I have a very long history with the Racine Dominican Eco Justice Center, and I know that many of the listeners of the morning show are very familiar and dedicated to the Racine Dominican Eco Justice Center. And of course, as many of us know, for a long time, it was shepherded and guided and run by Sister Janet Weicker as the executive director, who, as we all know, is a force of nature and then some. And for quite some time, succession planning was undertaken because, you know, people have to retire eventually.
Even Sister Janet,
yes. In Sister Janet's own way, of course. And fortunately, that succession planning and the search has brought to Racine, Wisconsin, Sister Regen Saitaki, who is the new executive director of the Racine Dominican Eco Justice Center. And so it's fitting and proper for us to have her on the show so she can tell us about herself and what her ideas and her dreams and visions are for the Eco Justice Center in her very long 3-month stay so far at the Eco Justice Center.
Right. It's a little bewildering to be here quite so soon when you're scarcely unpacked, but but it is great to have you here, and we're excited to hear about your vision for the Eco Justice Center and learn a little more about the gifts and experience that you bring to it. So first of all, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you.
For what I trust is just the first of a number of visits that you'll pay to our program. Let's begin by just learning a little bit about you sort of biographically.
Okay.
Where do you come from originally, and at least sketch the path which ultimately brought you to Racine and to the Eco Justice Center?
Sure. So I claim, even though I was actually born in Madison, Wisconsin, but moved when I was one. So I claim Kansas City is home.
Mm.
That is where I grew up. And it is where I met the Sisters of Charity of Leavenworth and entered and have been a sister now for 11 years. Also during that time, I was an elementary education teacher and really got my curiosity whetted with environmental education during that time. I spent a couple years in Denver, and they have a really fantastic sustainable community out there, and worked with Denver Urban Gardens and started doing just a small plot school garden with my fourth graders there, and started a compost bin, just a homemade with like an 18-gallon tub compost bin, so that they could see the actual cycle from garden to food waste back to the compost and the fertilizer on the garden. So doing that then led me to do a master's in earth literacy out of Terre Haute, the St. Mary the Wood College is located there, and it's also the same place Sister Janet went and got a certificate as well.
Mm.
And Terre Haute has a place called White Violet Eco Justice Center, and so both Sister Janet and I are familiar with that place. And They also have alpacas and a CSA. So it's kind of a neat, it's just neat to, having been there and had that connect with Sister Janet, that I have ended up here. I have a couple friends who are Cincinnatoan Dominicans, and they are the ones that told me of this opening.
Uh-huh.
And that's how I kind of ended up here. I should backtrack one little bit. So I taught elementary ed for about 10 years. And when I ended up in Leavenworth and taught there, I created a much bigger school garden as part of my thesis for that earth literacy degree. And then I was asked to come over to our University of St. Mary and became the environmental education coordinator there for a year, and then did some campus ministry. So from there, that's how I ended up here.
You know, you're rattling off all this, and I can scarcely believe how beautifully it folds into this position. I'm sure, Nan, you have to agree. Mm-hmm. That you just couldn't ask for a richer wealth of experience, mm-hmm. to align with what the Eco-Justice Center is all about.
That's perfect. Yes.
Yeah. I'm curious to hear more about this notion of a degree in earth literacy. That this is the first time I've ever heard that as an academic discipline, but What a fascinating concept. So what does it mean to study earth literacy?
Sure. So it is very interdisciplinary. And so it was a three-year program, and it was a hybrid where a lot of it was online, but you came together for 5 days each semester with kind of a cohort with your peers to meet the professor and hear some lectures. And so the first year was on ecology, so really getting a scientific foundation. Then the second year, we did a semester on economics and how earth and creation is treated within our current economic model, and exploring other models that would take into account natural resources not necessarily just being free. Another one was on culture and how different cultures, what their paradigm of earth and living in relationship with earth looks like. We did another one on art and spirituality. And finally, one was on being like a change agent back in your community.
Mm-hmm.
So like I said, it was very holistic, not so much like a lot of people take an environmental sustainability or environmental education, or it's not so science-based.
Right.
So it was very, very well done. It allows your thesis is kind of where your passion point is.
Right.
So for me, it was gardening. For someone else, you know, they might be working with the transitions community, and so trying to foster that where they were.
Mm-hmm.
So it really was a worthwhile degree.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it has been discontinued. The Sisters of Providence, who work at St. Mary the Woods College, and administration, it just didn't work out.
Yeah,
unfortunately, to continue it.
Yeah, but I can see how it would be so valuable, because it's a lot about culture.
Yes.
and connecting with your community and how best to effectively kind of communicate some of these concerns and foster some of this interest and concern among the community, which
right.
is a whole different thing than learning the chemistry behind decomposition or whatever it might be.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Can you trace all of these interests that you've poured your energies into professionally back to your childhood? I mean, did you grow up in a home where the garden was kind of the center of everything, where does this spring from, or does it really spring first and foremost from kind of a spiritual place, so to speak?
You know, I grew up in the suburbs. My mom grew up on a farm, so we would go back and visit the farm. But she really left the farm. The one thing growing up, we had flower gardens that I helped take care of. So in some ways, it is kind of coming full circle with connecting with her parents. But they passed away when I was pretty young. So there's that aspect. My dad's side, he had a pretty good acreage and had a creek in the backyard, and so loved to be outside and playing in that creek. I think it whetted my appetite.
Mm.
And then just recreation-wise, my father was a biker, and liked to go sailing. So outdoors was always a place that I loved growing up. And I think what really sparked my interest going to that spirituality piece is after I graduated from University of Notre Dame, I did a year of service out in New York and spent about a week with the Passionist Nuns in Clark Summit, Pennsylvania. And there was a young sister there who had an organic farm, and I got to work a week with her on that farm, and she ran a summer garden camp for preschool kids. And that's the point where I really say, my passion and my, love for God kind of just coalesced.
Right.
And it started me on the path to becoming a sister and working with Earth. Hmm. To me, they are intertwined.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, our very special guest in this portion of the morning show is Sister Rejen Saitaki, who is the new executive director of Racine's Eco-Justice Center. And Nan Calvert, of course, is with us as well. She facilitated this whole conversation. And Nan, you should actually probably spell out what your own relationship to the Eco-Justice Center is. It goes back quite a ways, doesn't it?
Yeah, actually, right when it started, Sister Rejen and I were talking out in the waiting area. And I remember I met Sister Janet when I was still a staff educator at Riverbend Nature Center. And Sister Janet was one of my volunteers. And then very quickly, that relationship flipped. I became one of Sister Janet's volunteers. and then eventually was a paid staff person at the Eco-Justice Center. And it was one of the most rewarding, challenging, and fulfilling things that I've ever done in terms of my relationship with the Eco-Justice Center. And what's been wonderful has been to be involved with its evolution, really refining its focus and its message, and using the land as a classroom, for stewardship and for relationship with the land. So it's very exciting now, this next phase. I'm really looking forward to watching it unfold, and hopefully in some way, as much as I can, being a part of that.
Hmm. So Sister Rejen Saitaki, for somebody who has not had the pleasure of visiting the Eco-Justice Center, explain what they will find.
Sure. Well, we're built on four kind of core values of community, contemplation, creativity, and cultivation. So when you first come on the property, on the right you will see our alpaca palace with our alpacas, and then on the left you'll start seeing gardens. And then as you walk further down the path, you'll see the farmhouse, which has been expanded, and there are currently four Racine Dominicans who live there. Sister Janet is one of them, along with Sister Rosemary, Sister Kathleen, and Sister Marianne. And then on the left, you'll see our education center, which is where I have my office, along with Sarah Ronovic, who is the programs and communication coordinator. And and it's also a good classroom space. And as you go around the corner, you'll see our barn, where we also do programming in as well. And that's where our goat pen is, and our ducks and our geese stay on the other bottom half. And to the left, you'll see the granary and the chicken coop. So if you stay on the path, that's where you go. But we have 15 acres, and so if you wander off, you'll see we have a labyrinth. We have a really creative treehouse that children love. And we have about 7 acres in hay, which we've this past year designed a farm corps program where high school students come and learn the process of growing food and selling it at market. So we still have that garden, and our latest addition is a hoop house, which we're about completing construction on to extend our growing season.
Right, and I happen to, thanks to my dad and stepmom, I know what a hoop house is, but for those who don't know what a hoop house is.
It's a portable greenhouse. This one's pretty cool. It's almost like on skis, so that you take the tractor and you can pull it back and forth over different plots of land. It's 22 by 48 feet long, and the hoop means it has the top part is curved pieces of metal that you pull a big piece of plastic over it. So again, it, like I said, it's portable and pretty easy to use. Yeah.
When I visited the Eco Justice Center for the first time, one of my most vivid memories of it was of us getting sort of attacked by two of the geese, and I don't remember which of the sisters was telling. It was not Sister Janet that day, but I remember. I mean,
it was Rosie and Chive. I know that.
Okay, because the one kind of nipped at me a little bit, and so this sister just reached down and just grabbed them both by the neck and just kind of walked off with them. And they were squawking and wings flapping, but I just remember thinking, So these are what the Sisters of the Eco Justice Center, have to deal with. I mean, it's a place where you get your hands dirty and you're occasionally dealing with obstinate and aggressive geese and all kinds of other issues that are involved. And it was just really interesting because, on the one hand, it's the most, it's one of the most beautiful places you'll ever see, idyllic in so many ways. And yet it isn't sort of that.
Oh, there's lots of noise.
Yeah, and it's not like a Candyland kind of fake serenity. It's also a place where a lot of hard work takes place and where you confront certain realities that are part of working the land and working with the world of nature and working with animals, right up to the big, gigantic compost heap that's kind of in the middle of it all that is not everybody's sense idea of a thing of beauty, but you take it all together. And the place is just breathtaking. It really is.
Yeah.
It sounds like you have encountered places like it before, and yet is it fair to say that this is a place that kind of has a special charm all its own?
Oh, absolutely. I just think that it's very having those four core values really helps kind of keep the mission in front of us. And, it melds the cultivation and the earth and the animals and seeing how you live in relationship. But that contemplation piece is really important. We have a hermitage on site if people want to get away. We have a labyrinth, which is a walking meditation. So even in the midst of, now we have guinea hens.
Oh.
We have like 35 keets, which are the baby guinea hens. So we have a lot of noise going on, but it is. There is still space and time for people to contemplate.
Right.
Yeah.
So who primarily comes to the Eco Justice Center, and typically what do they do when they come?
Sure. We have about 6,000 visitors annually, and I would say a lot, there's a lot of children that come on field trips, or we have week-long summer camps in the summer. That is a huge target audience. We also have a lot of volunteers, that are teenagers to adults. And that's another avenue that people kind of come to us, as well as people who come on the weekends. And we have self-guided tours that people can just come and wander the property and look at everything. So that's our audience. But we also do some programming. Like tonight, we're starting a book club in defense of food with Michael Pollan. It'll be at the Siena Center if anyone's interested. And on Wednesdays from 6:30 to 8.
Mm-hmm.
But so we try to not only make it for children, but also tie in adults as well.
Very good.
Yep.
So I guess part of the sort of the ongoing work of the place is just maintaining it, let alone sort of launching anything new or, ushering in a new chapter. Just talk about, and I don't mean sustaining in the sense of sustainability exactly, but
sure.
Talk about just the work of sustaining a place like this. And I don't mean financially either.
Okay.
I mean keeping the chickens alive and keeping the gardens flourishing and so on. I mean, just what is involved in keeping the Eco Justice Center flourishing in those respects?
Sure. Well, right now, there are two of us that are full-time staff, myself and Sarah, and then Sister Janet is our volunteer coordinator, and Sister Rosemary also assists. So they are volunteer, but they do a good chunk of work, and I'm very grateful. But I would say our lifeblood really is our volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
So while Sarah and I are the ones that are maybe doing the morning chores with the animals, it's the volunteers that come on the property that might do the mucking out of the geese barn, or helping maintain some of the gardens or the grounds. And so that's really what it takes.
Wow.
To continue to be sustainable. We also, there is one other staff, Michael Rashke is our maintenance man as well,
mm-hmm.
but he's part-time.
How many volunteers are we talking about?
Oh, golly. In a year's time, where they're kind of coming on a consistent basis, I would say at least 200.
Wow.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Yeah. Well, and we just had our fall festival, and we had 160 people volunteer alone to make that one event, you know, a success.
Wow.
So, yes.
So Nan Calvert was making reference to kind of a new chapter or new possibilities in the future, and we need to spend a little bit of time talking about some of your hopes and dreams for the future for the Eco-Justice Center.
Sure. Well, I really think at this point, I'm just trying to get to know the larger Racine community. But I think there's a lot of possibilities in partnering up with other nonprofits that do similar work. And, you know, we were kind of having that conversation out in the lobby, you know, and I've had a conversation with 4-H, so far, and, just, you know, I kind of want to explore getting more groups together, you know, and I'd love to try and connect with Will Allen and just see what are some possibilities for us down the road. Especially around environmental education. And also, I think, since we have all those gardens, are we bringing people on to really teach what organic gardening can look like and trying new methods?
Mm.
So, you know, kind of expanding. We do a lot with the field trips and children, but can we go in a different way? And even right now, we're start kicking off healthy living, healthy habits, which is targeting third graders in 6 schools that are 85% free and reduced lunch.
Mm.
And it's part of a grant with SC Johnson and All Saints Foundation. And I'd like to build on that, because it's not just giving them a tour of the place, but, you know, tasting the food, talking about what does it mean to be eating more plants in your diet, and, you know, how cool is it to see it from the garden to your table. So, you know, that can be a springboard for some more programming into the future.
Mm.
I was just thinking, is that a precursor or an extension of the Farm Corps program?
Well, those two things are separate at this point, but in a way it could be, you know, something that you could start with children at certain ages and kind of do touch points along the way until they're in high school and can really get their hands in the dirt with us at the
literally and figuratively.
Yes.
So as you think about your sense of mission and partnering with other organizations, which of course is the greatest idea, what is sort of at the heart of what you see as the mission of the Eco-Justice Center? I mean, in terms of, you know, for instance, your own passion point, what is the most urgent need that you want the Eco-Justice Center to address?
Mm. Well, I see it as it's a hub. It's a hub, like a learning center hub for the larger community to come in and connect with others who are doing similar things, but kind of an education center for best practices, because we know those are always constantly changing in the realm of farming, gardening, or even renewable energy. Like, I just think there's you know, we have those three components of the gardens, the animals, and the renewable energy. Like, those can be, you know, you have the hub of people, and then these are the areas that we can offer for that. So you know, I think that's what I really see.
Hmm. Yeah. Who owns the Eco Justice Center?
The Racine Dominicans.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, own the property. Yes.
And so they in a sense keep the doors open.
Yes. We are a separate nonprofit. Hmm. You know, and we do pay rent to the Racine Dominicans. So it is a partnership,
right,
at this point.
So for people who are interested in supporting what you do and or being part of it, a part of what you do, what are the most likely opportunities that people should think about?
As far as?
Well, I mean, volunteering or financially supporting you or in any and above all of the above.
Sure. Well, yes, we support ourselves a lot on donations, and so we are always grateful for that, and it goes towards our programming. So things like we need scholarships for children coming for field trips or summer camp, for the Farm Corps program. We can always use assistance with that. Volunteers, I really hope to, in the future, kind of streamline volunteers into areas where, you know, we do have a lot of people who work on the grounds, but we can always use assistance in our programming. So, for example, if we have a field trip of 50 children, it's nice to break them up into groups of 10. And so people that would love to come and help us with tours, especially like retired teachers, would be a fantastic group of volunteers I would love to try and tap into. And then certain programs need, since we're working with food, help prepping and setting up and clean up. So those are the three areas I really see needing help with volunteers.
Very good. And I imagine you're very grateful to have the wonderful Sister Janet still on hand. I mean, as someone who's such a part of the place and knows its history, and I'm sure is supportive of you in every way.
Yes, she's a great mentor and is a wealth of knowledge that I can ask questions about. So I am grateful.
Very good. Well, it's a beautiful, beautiful place, and it's a place that's also, in a sense, a jewel kind of tucked away a little bit. It's not a place you're likely to just drive past by accident. So place you need to seek out, and it's worth seeking out. It's a beautiful place to visit. I've been there on several different Saturday afternoons, and it was just, you just don't want to leave. And it's a combination of just being in a place that is so quiet and so beautiful, and yet a place where really exciting things are happening. The last time I came was right after the compost toilet had been installed.
Oh.
And so they were showing that with great, great pride. I think that's in the Hermitage.
Yeah, correct.
This beautiful little, almost like a little cabin in the woods that one can rent and spend time in. And so it's wonderful how the place is so, in one way, timeless. Mm-hmm. I mean, you go onto the grounds and you feel like you're stepping back in time. And yet you're also in a place that is always thinking forward, thinking about the newest, best ways to do some of these things that are important for nurturing the earth. So it's an exciting place to be, and it sounds like you're exactly the right person to be at its helm. So we wish you well with the years that stretch ahead for you, and again, I hope we'll be having more visits on the morning show.
Thank you very much, Greg. I'm just thrilled to be here this morning.
And by the way, what's the website address for?
You can just type in ecojusticecenter.org, and it'll pop up. And for those that don't know where we are, if you know where Cliffside Park is, you will see us first on McNair Road before you get there.
Very good. Mm-hmm. Sister Regine Saitaki, the new executive director of the Eco Justice Center. Nan, I'm so glad you brought her along today. This is a wonderful conversation. And Nan, what's going on that you want us to know about?
Well, as usual, there are a lot of wonderful things going on. Speaking of the Eco Justice Center, a program that they'll have on November 5th is called Energy Efficiency in Your Home. The cost is $5. There are some scholarships available. During this program, you'll learn practical steps to reduce your utility costs and household environmental impact by more than half compared to national averages. You'll be able to understand how your carbon footprint relates to global emissions levels and reduce those targets. The guide for the program will be Casey McIntosh. All you have to do is go to the Eco Justice Center's website, and you can register right there. On October 20th, a Thursday evening at 6:30, our favorite Sierra Club group, the Southeast Gateway Group, will be presenting Challenges to Our Great Lakes. The speaker for the evening will be Dr. Michael Carvin of the UW-Milwaukee School of Freshwater Sciences. He's one of the researchers there, and his particular interests are in environmental toxicology and environmental genetics. He'll be addressing emergent water quality issues in Wisconsin and the Great Lakes, including non-point source pollution, atmospheric, surface water, groundwater, and stormwater runoff, with a focus on nutrients and veterinary drugs from agriculture, pesticides, and mercury pollution from coal-burning power plants. That program is at 6:30 at the IMET Center. Please go to the Southeast Gateway Group's Facebook page and or website, and you can get more information and also register there. I don't believe that there's a cost for the program. Hawthorne Hollow will be presenting Winter Birds with Rick Fair on Saturday, November 5th from 10 a.m. until noon. The fee includes a bird feeder. Go to Hawthorne Hollow's website and you can get more information. And finally, Seno Conservancy will be presenting Pine Needle Basketry with artist Roberta Condon from the Driftless Folk School in Wisconsin. That'll be on November 12th at 9 o'clock until 3 p.m. All materials will be included, as well as lunch. Call for registration, 539-3222. And there are pictures of the kinds of things that will be created on our Facebook page, as well as our website, which has been down for a while, but now through the miracles of the internet is back up again.
All right. Hey. Let's hear it for modern technology once in a while. Nan Calvert, it's always great to have you here. And again, thank you so much for introducing me and all of our listeners to Sister Rejane Saitaki today. This was a great pleasure.
You're most welcome, and it was my pleasure as well.
So we'll see you in November. I'm Mary Burke. The time is 8:42, and part two of today's morning show, an interview from the archives, is coming up in just a moment here on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I hold in my hands an absolutely beautiful, even mesmerizing memoir called Life from Scratch, a memoir of food, family, and forgiveness, written by a woman by the name of Sasha Martin. And you perhaps know her from an extraordinary adventure of sorts which she undertook, which was encapsulated in a website you can still visit called Global Table Adventure, in which she, for her family, cooked a different recipe from essentially every country on the face of the earth. And when one visits that website, you can see many of the recipes which she used and blog accounts about some of those culinary adventures, if you will. Well, now we hear, in a sense, the story behind that story in this wonderful memoir called Life from Scratch, in which we not only find out a little bit more about what prompted Sasha Martin to undertake that journey of extraordinary discovery, but the story behind her early life and the way in which, in a sense, the ground was laid for her to want to explore this as she has. And I'm so excited to be able to speak with Sasha Martin for the next few minutes about her memoir, Life from Scratch, which has just been published by National Geographic. Sasha Martin, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be on with you today, Greg.
I think a lot of people may be surprised if they know something about your website and this wonderful adventure that you've undertaken, that when we pick up the memoir, the story is about quite a bit more than that. I know I, for one, was really surprised, but I loved the book, so I ultimately was very pleasantly surprised. As you sat about writing your own story, were you surprised as well that, in a sense, so much of the backstory became front and center?
Yes, This was not the book I meant to write. It was very early on in the writing process that my editor challenged me. She said, Sasha, it's not a normal thing to be cooking a meal from every country in the world A to Z for 4 years. And she pushed me, you know, because I had a pretty happy-go-lucky outline going for my first draft of the book. And so I went back. She, you know, sent me away to have some self-reflection. And I kept going back to my childhood and this, you know, trying to figure out what this yearning for belonging, where that was coming from. And the challenges I went through as a child were such a force in my life. So in and out of foster homes, struggling with poverty, things like that, that I knew I couldn't write about my hunger for peace and cooking the world if I didn't first make peace with my past. Mm. And so that's the book did grow, and it became this enormous undertaking that I never expected to get into so
right.
soon.
It's a marvelous book, one of the best memoirs I think I've ever read. We should say right off the bat that your mother was a very, very intriguing, gifted woman who loved you very much, but a very unconventional parent. And at one point, she was, in a sense, compelled to give you up to the foster care system. Just briefly say a word about sort of the events which precipitated that drastic move, that drastic decision on her part.
Well, you know, there's a lot of things going on, but definitely, like as you said, she was unconventional, and it was the kind of thing where, you know, if my brother and her got in a fight and it was the middle of the night and it was freezing cold out and he stormed outside in his pajamas and he sat on the curb pouting barefoot and there's snow outside, she would let him and she would say, he'll come back in when he cools off. You know, it was kind of that free-range parenting before it became the buzzword of today. And, you know, social services would drive by and that was the kind of thing that just didn't fly. And
we should maybe mention that we should mention that your mother also was a single mother for most of your childhood, and so is struggling in sometimes unconventional ways to just put food on the table and provide some kind of a life for you and your brother. And evidently a few of the choices she made might not have been the optimal choices, shall we say.
Yeah, I mean, there was a challenging time, and you know, I think when you are under that sort of pressure financially, and you don't have somebody you can go to, you know, a partner that you trust and love that will help balance out all those emotions. She was just there was a lot on her shoulders, and so. Over time, it became more and more challenging, and by the time I was 10 years old, she did end up requesting that somebody take care of my brother and me, and so it ended up being old family friends of hers, which it was sort of a gift that connection was possible.
Right.
To complete strangers.
But mm-hmm. What's interesting is you write at one point, there's a difference between poverty of resources and poverty of spirit. For a long time, Michael, that's your brother, and I were oblivious to hardship because of Mom's determined efforts. So in a sense, one of the gifts she gave you was her own resourcefulness as she tried to cobble together interesting meals with next to no money to be able to spend on ingredients. And I suppose maybe that's one way in which she has served as an inspiration to you all these years later.
Absolutely. My favorite recipe of hers is the German tree cake she made for us when I was a little kid, you know, a rainy day activity. It's sort of an outrageous cake, 19 layers. There's no reason to make a cake that complicated, but I don't know, it was just the sort of fantastical thing that she would bring into our lives and give us that sense of playfulness and fun no matter what. I mean, my brother and I were sleeping in the living room. We didn't have a bedroom, and so that kitchen was that central place that pulled us together where anything could happen, and that was a real gift.
Right. Well, ultimately, as you said, you and your brother are given over to this couple, Pierre and Patricia, who care for you very attentively, and ultimately a change in his work takes you to Paris and then to Luxembourg and onto quite an adventure. But one of the most intriguing things about your life with them is that Patricia did not want you in the kitchen. And that was so foreign to you, having been in the kitchen all the time with your own mother. And it sounds like that also was a way in which you came to understand and more deeply appreciate what that had meant for you and what it means for you now to be in the kitchen cooking food for family and friends, having been excluded from that for a while.
Yeah, and that was extremely difficult. And I will say that as a young girl, I think we often don't know how to voice what we need, especially, you know, I'm living with this new family, and I mean, there's just so many challenges. And so I didn't speak up. I didn't say what I was missing. And so instead, I survived like we all do. So I went out into the streets of Paris and Luxembourg, and I went to the boulangerie and the creperie and the fromagerie, and I got my culinary education that way. But it was always sort of this restlessness. You know, they provided this tremendous education. They definitely provided my wanderlust that inspired this adventure, right? I went to 12 countries by the age of 19, thanks to their generosity and the experiences I had through their through living with them. But yeah, in terms of the food, it almost became a little bit of a holy grail for me, because it was forbidden, and so finding ways to kind of sneak it into my life, right, as a teenager was the thing.
I think one of the most touching moments in the book is when you talk about how Patricia, your foster mother, went back to the United States to care for her own father, and you and your foster father, Pierre, had to, in a sense, kind of forge a new life in which suddenly you found yourself in the kitchen, welcome in the kitchen, and one of the first times you made a real meal for your good friend Annie and your dad, and you thanked him when it was all done, and you said, thank you. Suddenly tears were in my eyes. I don't think you'll ever realize what this means to me. It was one of my happiest high school experiences, building friendship while sharing the joy of communal dining and creation. I mean, probably not until that moment did you realize what a beautiful thing it is simply to be in the kitchen cooking for family and friends.
That's right. That was a tremendous experience. And I think you're right. When things are gone from our lives and we get them back again, they just shine so much more brilliantly, I think.
Right.
And so, yeah, that was a tremendous experience. And also to be so young and to have these dinner parties and be able to, I mean, I made pasta from scratch. I didn't just have friends over and make, you know, macaroni and cheese. We're rolling pasta out on the table. I mean, I just went nuts, because it was like somebody who'd been starving who gets to eat again. And so I did the most complicated thing I could possibly do at for that age, right? Mm-hmm. It was pretty awesome.
Well, you write so beautifully about all of these various experiences, I mean, with your family and the difficulties and your own personal resurgence, and fast forward now to being married to your husband and with your young daughter, embarking on this amazing adventure of cooking recipes essentially from every country on earth. And you recount much of that, and some of the recipes are actually in this book, Life from Scratch. As you did that through literally hundreds of recipes from nearly 200 countries around the world, how often did you end up cooking something that you sort of regretted versus the recipes where you were so glad that you were sitting down and eating this wonderful meal from Botswana or wherever it might have been? I mean, very often did you find yourself regretting certain specific choices?
Oh, my gosh. Well, almost never, to be honest. I mean, there were definitely times that were very, very challenging. There's a time in the book that's recounted where with Angola, I made a huge mistake in how I prepared this dish called baton de manioc. And it's basically cassava. Some people call it yuca or manioc. You grate the cassava into banana leaf packets and you steam it. And it sounds simple enough. There were a lot of special directions, like soak the cassava and steam for hours and hours. And I thought, wow, that's a lot of, you know, that's a lot of trouble. I wonder why it has to cook so long. But I did what they said, thinking they know best. Well, what I missed from the instructions was that the sort of tough, fibery center of the cassava should not be grated into the packet. And this can have trace amounts of cyanide. And so they didn't tell, you know, I didn't have this information, but nobody in my family was interested in trying this dish. I mean, I think they all took one bite, and then I'm looking at these packets that I spent all day grating and steaming. And so in an act of frustration, I ate a whole bunch to prove a point. And I got really sick that night. And they'd say that the cassava that's in the United States has been treated so that it doesn't have any traces of cyanide anymore. But I'm not sure I believe that after what I experienced. It was pretty rough.
Fortunately, that was a very exceptional experience. And for the most part, it was an extraordinarily joyous experience and adventure for you and your very picky eater of a husband, Keith, and your young daughter, Ava. You say at one point, before she was five, she had eaten the entire world. And I love how you say that this adventure has really helped all of you, in a sense, understand the world. It's made the world, in a sense, a smaller and friendlier place for you.
Yeah, that's right. It was a joyous experience and a delicious one. And I think it's just, it's the idea of getting to know your global neighbors, right? I just, there were so many countries that we know so little about. So we hear about Chinese food, we hear about French food, and we have millions of cookbooks and stories about these places, but there are so many hidden gems around the world that I more and more as I went along on this adventure, I became determined to just celebrate every country equally. And I think part of that goes back to my mom's struggles that I write about in the first part of the book, because we're all, no matter where we're from, trying to just do the best we can for our family. We're trying to put food on the table, and so many of these countries become known for their one issue. And I think that does a disservice to the millions of people that are really sort of apart from that issue, and they're just trying to come together in community, just like my mom did with us. And so it was a real pleasure to share those recipes. And now I have people from those smaller countries writing me and saying, thank you for celebrating my country's food. It's such an honor. You did a nice job. Sometimes they send corrections, which are good too. But it's just such a fun thing.
Mm-hmm. The book is Life from Scratch, a memoir of food, family, and forgiveness, published by National Geographic. And you can also visit her website, globaltableadventure.com, where you can read more about this undertaking and order from her a free starter guide if you would like to know a little bit more about how you might do this for yourself and your family and friends. Sasha Martin, thank you so much for writing such a compelling book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Best wishes to you.
Thank you so much, Greg. It was an honor to be with you.
And the time is 8:58 here on WGTD, your gateway to public radio. And I want to tell you about some morning shows that are coming up in the near future. And it looks like we're going to have a very, very interesting few days on the program, beginning with tomorrow's program. It's going to be busy with three different interviews, all musically related. We'll start with a preview of Saturday night's concert of the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra with a member of the orchestra, the president of the board, and the executive director of the symphony. We're also going to be talking with Wael Farouk, who is the newest member of the music faculty at Carthage. And he's going to be playing his first faculty recital at Carthage Saturday night. He is a marvelous concert pianist, and we'll be talking with him about what he's going to be playing. We'll also speak to another concert pianist who is playing a performance at the Siena Center tomorrow evening. It's a program devoted entirely to the exciting music of Aram Khachaturian. So that is tomorrow on The Morning Show. Next week on Monday, you'll hear the interview, which I have recorded, will be recording later today, with Dan Simons, who is a professor of psychology at the University of Illinois. He was recently featured on NPR's Morning Edition for an important study he headed up, studying studies about brain games, and actually coming to the conclusion that most of the studies that said that those were very, very helpful for making people mentally sharp were actually very poorly done studies that proved nothing of the kind. He's most famous for his book, The Invisible Gorilla, which talks about the limits of our